Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept it, hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day two of this Rahatsu session here in December 2017 at Mountain Gate. Rahatsu session, as you already know, memorializes the what probably is the first session ever, that of Shakyamuni Buddha or Gautama, when he sat down determined to look inward, having not found his answers outward, and determined to sit until he found his answers. And he did, as he glanced up at the morning star on the eighth morning of this retreat, this personal little retreat that he did. And ever since, for millennia, people have been gathering in special places to do these retreats, the special Rohatsu Sesshin. And right now, all over the world, no doubt, other people are actually sitting as well. And the gathered energy is profound. It can help take us very deep. When we add our own energy to it, our deepening interior search, that will expand and help all beings. So I'd like to continue, as is the tradition in Rinzai temples, with sharing with you Master Hakuin's Rohatsu exhortations. Hakuin Zenji, Hakuin Ekaku, and was a 18th century Zen master in Japan, Rinzai master, who single-handedly resurrected Rinzai Zen practice in Japan. In those days, the practice was to go from temple to temple as the different masters were giving lectures on different sutras. I don't know where Zazen fit into that. It's not clear in his records, other than some of his own instructions to his students, which initially were quite intense and eventually mellowed out, because when he did it the intense way, he got himself sick. He made himself a nervous wreck. He did get a Kensho experience, but at a great cost, and he had to learn how to work in a very different way, which is why in the Rinzai sect, in Rinzai temples, the emphasis on being in your hara, in other words, your tanden or tantien, if you know martial arts, but in your belly, it's as if your energy, as if your mind is seated in your belly, just a few fingers width below your navel. When we move and live from here, it's a very deeply grounding place. And also, in terms of Zazen, it helps keep us centered and anchored and grounded. If we don't practice from our hara, we can end up with a great deal of tension in our neck, in our shoulders, in our heads. And it doesn't help. It hinders our practice. So here we are, day two, with Master Hakuin. The Master said, the Sharangama Sutra says that when a person returns to truth, with a capital T, in the attainment of the way, everything in all the ten directions, including empty space itself, vanishes without a trace. And that is the deep, profound samadhi one reaches just before Kensho. There are many different kinds of samadhi. For example, when we're reading a really good book, we're lost in the book. We're in a level of samadhi, but we're not necessarily going to come to awakening through that level of samadhi. That's just a deep awareness, a deep presence. That said, in order to reach the depth of samadhi, one must reach at least for a short while in order to come to some level of awakening. It has to be total presence. It has to be a total forgetting of the self. Because it is this idea of being somebody this self-image that we have to protect and maintain, and it's dangerous to be without. We have to let go of it in order to realize who we really are and experience the depth of freedom that comes from that. He continues, anywhere people engage in the practice of the way, protecting deities and obstructing deities are also present. It's like crowds gathering in towns and cities and drawing thieves there as well. When a student's mind is focused firmly in the great vow of universal salvation, the protecting deities gain strength. But when the mind begins to waver and impede itself, it is the obstructing deities who strengthen. It is thus absolutely essential that you begin your practice by arousing the great Bodhisattva vow, focusing your mind with selfless humility on the suffering of sentient beings, rooting it in the fervent prayer that each and every one of them reach the deliverance of enlightenment. No one has ever attained full realization of the great way of the Buddhas who is not inspired by the power of this vow. It is like the practice of archery. You won't hit the center of the target the first or second time you shoot an arrow, or the third or fourth. But in time, if you continue to practice diligently, you are sure to grasp the knack. In practicing Zen, it is the same. A great burning resolve must well up at each and every instant of thought, focusing all your energy on penetrating the profound source of the Buddha way. When you are able to do this without wavering for even a single instant of thought, the Dharma truth cannot help but manifesting itself in its entirety before your eyes. You will arrive at the Buddha's supreme enlightenment with less effort than it takes to reach down and pick up a piece of dirt at your feet. And let's talk a little bit more about this. Anywhere people engage in the practice of the way, protecting deities and obstructing deities are also present. It's like crowds gathering in towns and cities and drawing thieves there as well. When a student's mind is focused firmly in the great vow of universal salvation, protecting deities gain strength. But when the mind begins to waver and impede itself, it is the obstructing deities who strengthen. This is one way of putting it. Our habit patterns of distraction are quite strong. Growing up, we are able to focus to a certain degree, but then we also allow ourselves to be distracted, particularly before we get into Zen practice. It's sort of the customary way we are. Very, very few people go about fully present in each moment. And perhaps this is why the mindfulness movement is gaining such strength here in the West. Those habit patterns have etched their way into our brain. And in order to change this, we need to continually bring our mind back to the practice. Back to the practice. Back to the practice. For some time, it depends on our powers of concentration and our commitment to coming to awakening. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. Then we will be able to increasingly focus on the practice with less and less distraction. That said, as soon as we allow ourselves a tiny little bit of distraction, we can think, oh, won't hurt to think this right now, won't hurt to check that right now, but it's amazing what it can lead us far, far away to in the process, far, far away from our practice. This is why it's so emphasized not to talk during sesshin, but to give ourselves totally to the practice. Because it's hard. It's not easy to continually focus, particularly when our habits are quite the opposite. And especially in modern day West, there are so many distractions, so many tempting distractions. We have all of our electronic toys to play with. And that is shown to actually inhibit our ability to focus. There's a book called The Shallows, in which a person has done some research into this and discovered that actually working with electronic media changes our brain, and sometimes not in the best directions. He quotes a number of people who are deeply into work with words. They are authors, or they are commentators, or they are professors, and they find that they cannot read a book anymore. They cannot focus long enough to read a book. This is going to have some ramifications. So is it any wonder that we have difficulty focusing on our practice single-mindedly, continually? So don't be dismayed. Rather, use that experience of getting dragged away by thoughts, by ideas, by creative solutions to whatever, to recommit to the practice. When we start practice, we are committed to a certain level, but it's not until we are fully committed that the practice can really take off. In the meantime, it's so often pulling ourselves back to the practice, pulling ourselves back to the practice, pulling ourselves back to the practice, because at some level we are maybe 90% committed, 95% committed. But it's not until we are 100% committed to doing the practice, to coming to full awakening, that it begins to be streamlined. If we've had an experience before we ever start practice where we realize that that's the only way for any lasting peace and happiness for us, then that can be of great benefit in helping us reach that full level of commitment. But if not, there will always be this beckoning door saying, "Oh, come on out and play. It won't hurt. What good is Zen practice anyway?" And particularly when we run into rough water, that doorway will really, really be enticing. If we truly want to be free, and this freedom is freedom from our own stuff. It's freedom from that self-image and the tyranny of that self-image that demands that we act in certain ways. And when we can't live up to that acting, then it slams us. And we go down in depression and anxiety and fear. Part of this is culturally expected. We belong to a society, and there are certain ways of behavior that are expected. And if we step aside of the line one way or another, and some parts of society are more rigid than others, then we get hit for it. But the real freedom comes when we can align ourselves with what is right and true, and move freely in compassion, through wisdom, throughout our life. And somehow then, as Shita Wunan said famously in a short poem, "Die while alive and be completely dead, then do what you will, all is good." I'll leave you with that one to ponder. It is thus absolutely essential that you begin your practice by arousing the great Bodhisattva vow, focusing your mind with selfless humility on the suffering of sentient beings, rooting it in the fervent prayer that each and every one of them reach the deliverance of enlightenment. This may be why any number of Buddhists are vegetarians, because I know a number of people, including myself, who were shocked when they witnessed, I can only but recall the execution of an animal in the course of the duties of a farmer. It brings about a sense of a combination of horror and anguish for this chicken that is just flapping around headless. The farmer has just chopped his head off. And it's known that, for example, animals who are about to be slaughtered know that, and they don't like it. They react in fear. There are various stories about cows jumping out of the chute that would herd them into the slaughterhouse. And when I lived in Thailand, there was a Chinese restaurant that we used to go to. It was upstairs. The kitchen was downstairs, and one day we were at the restaurant and they brought in some pigs to slaughter right there in the restaurant kitchen. This is not something that would be done in the United States, but it's pretty common in other countries. And the pigs were screaming. It was horrifying to experience. And then at Hidden Valley Zen Center, we were having problems with rats chewing up the wires and interrupting the heating cooling system and the Zendo. And so one of our members, who happened to be a pest control person, put snap traps up there. And one time during a Sunday morning sitting, there was a rat that entered the snap trap. And the look of horror on this man's face when he realized what was going on as this dying rat was flapping around on the ceiling or in the attic was something to behold. Human beings have a great deal of empathy, and we are taught often to shut it down. I remember here, next door neighbor who used to raise turkeys enough for his family, and the grandson was at the time 3 years old, and as far as he was concerned, the turkeys were pets. And so he was horrified when his grandfather slaughtered the turkey and his grandmother cooked it up and he wouldn't eat it. And his grandmother said to me, "How silly, you won't even eat the turkey." I didn't say anything. It's a different culture, and you have to eat something. Personally, I prefer carrots. But this sensitivity and awareness to the suffering of human beings can bring us to being willing to commit to the Bodhisattva vow, which is to liberate all sentient beings. And to liberate all sentient beings doesn't mean to go out and grab people and proselytize and tell them that they have to come in and do zazen in order to be saved. Nothing like that at all. There's two aspects of this vow. One is that we are full of sentient beings ourselves, our thoughts, our ideas, and not all of them are representing the truth. We have habit patterns that encourage greed, anger, and delusion in us. And it's about these habit patterns, these sentient beings, these thoughts that we're seeking to liberate by seeing through them. And this is another reason why when things come up for us in Zazen, particularly in Sesshin, we don't try to stuff it, because when we do have them come up, particularly if they're strong things, there's a way to work with them through feeling their vital energy alone, not the story, just the energy, that can allow them to release and dissolve. That's one aspect of this vow to liberate all sentient beings. The other aspect is this: the more clear and let go we are in our own minds, in our own behavior, the more we are in accord with the truth with a capital T, so that our own behavior is filled with peace, compassion, empathy, that radiates out to other people. They feel it. People are energetically connected. Science has begun to realize this. And so it makes a difference. It's easy to tell when somebody around you is angry. You don't have to have any action involved with it. You can feel it. At the same time, if somebody's deeply peaceful, you can also experience that as well. And the more we expand a peaceful mind state, and in order to do that, we have to feel it fully ourselves. This is not something that we can do intentionally. When we ourselves are let go of the self-image to the point where even momentarily we can experience peace and a subtle sense of freedom ourselves, that is perceived by countless beings. Now I'd like to continue with what we were sharing the last two Sesshin, October and November Sesshin, and these are the letters of Dahui. Dahui was a Chan master, Chan being the Chinese way of pronouncing jhana, which was transliterated into Zen in Japan quite a long time ago. And he was so profound that his teachings are still being shared today, particularly in Korea, but also in Japan and in the West. And we are fortunate to be having access to a new translation. It's not yet published, but will be published soon, I hope, because it's quite excellent. Prior to this, the complete letters of Dahui weren't really available. There is one version that was translated by a professor that it costs almost $90. And this new version hopefully will be considerably less expensive. And it's done by a person who is a monk of long training and also a skilled translator. So we are already at chapter 25, and this is Dawi's letter to Wang Nehan, whose apparently last name is Yang Zhang. And I'm going to jump around in this because not all of it is relevant to us at this point. This man obviously is a high-ranking government official who has just decided to dedicate himself to Zazen. And Dawi says, or writes, "Your fame, Wang Yangzhen, fills the world. What have you gained in your daily life through deliberation, discernment, and scholarship? Our cultural refinement, reputation, and official status. When you sum it all up at the end of your life, what if this is real?" We could also ask, what are you going to be able to take with you? After your endless literary efforts, is there a single phrase that has truly done you any good? How much difference is there between those who are famed throughout the land and those who hide their virtue and conceal their light? Is an official who has reached the highest ranks really any different from what he was as a student who hadn't yet passed the examinations? You are now approaching 70. What more are you hoping to accomplish throughout the exertion of your talents? How will you settle accounts on the day of your death? The killer demons of impermanence do not halt for an instant. As Shui Feng Shen Jue said, our time is fleeting, and an instant is gone. How can one stay long in this ephemeral world? I was 32 when I left the mountain. It has already been 40 years since I came to Min. No use continually criticizing people's faults. Rather, should one steadily remove one's own failings I humbly inform the palace officials dressed in vermilion and purple, old Yama is unawed by your golden emblems of rank. In those days, only the people of highest ranks could wear those colors. And this is why in Japan today, the highest monks, they're not monks, they're masters, wear purple. It has a slightly different translation in the Blue Cliff Record and the 22nd case, and I'll share this with you as well. Human life, so hectic and hurried, is but a brief instant. This is a Cleary Brothers translation. How can you dwell for long in this fleeting world? As I reach 32, I emerge from the mountains. Already over 40, I return to Min. No use bringing up the faults of others again and again. One's own mistakes must be cleared away continuously. I humbly report to the purple-clad nobles who fill the courts. The king of death has no awe of the golden emblems of rank you hold. In other words, we live, we do what society expects us to do, we excel, perhaps, and then we die, and then what? Of what meaning are these accomplishments? Will they bring us any benefit the moment of death? Will it matter what rank we've had? Will it matter how famous we've been? What will matter? I have two friends who found out in very dangerous situations what really mattered. One of them was a Mexican friend who had been doing practice at the Rochester Zen Center for some time, and he went back to Mexico for a visit. Was visiting his girlfriend, left the apartment at 1 o'clock in the morning to go back to his house, and hailed a cab. And in those days, the cabs they were trying to introduce were for fuel economy and for some attempt at getting rid of the pollution or mitigating the pollution that was horrendous in Mexico City at the time. They brought out Volkswagen Bugs, and the way they became taxis was they took out the front passenger seat so that there was a pair of people that could sit in the back, plus the driver. And then you went in and out through the front door with inconvenience without that front seat there. So he got in and gave the address to the driver, and the driver said, well, you know, I know a quick way to get there. It'll cost you a lot less. And he said, nah, just go the regular way. And the man persisted. So finally, Angel said, okay, go your way. So the man pulled off the main road onto a side street, pulled up to a stop sign, and another man got in with a gun. And they proceeded then to take Angel around to three different banks because they had asked him to empty his pockets and they saw he had a credit card. And they thought, all right, we'll get some money out of this guy. But unfortunately, he had never memorized his PIN numbers, so he couldn't do that. And although he tried desperately to come up with something that would work, nothing did all three times. And the last time, when it was still a failure, they said, okay, get out, face down on the ground. And he knew he was going to be shot. And he lay down, face down on the sidewalk, desperately doing Susokan, which he had learned, the extended out breath, realizing that in those last moments before he was going to die, the only thing that mattered to him was to come to awakening. And then, miraculously, He suddenly realized after some minutes that he couldn't hear the sound of the car motor any longer. He dared to turn his head, and it was gone, which is why we know the story. The other story is of a friend who was American. He was a Buddhist monk in Japan, and at a certain point he began to have pain in his midsection whenever he ate anything. So he ate less and less and began to lose weight. He checked himself into the Western medical scene to get full examinations in Japan, because they have a good medical background there, both Western and Eastern, and they didn't find anything. So then he checked himself into a Eastern medicine hospital for a month, where every day he got acupuncture and moxa and ate different herbs and had what was appropriately healthy food intake, and still the pain persisted. It got worse. And so finally, having tried all the medical help that was possible in Japan, he went back to his apartment, and there another mutual friend of ours found him simply waiting to die. For 7 months he was in this condition. He went from 160 pounds to 105. The friend urged him to go back to the States to try one more thing. His father had been a medical doctor teaching at Yale University. And so he went back home to his father, and his father had a colleague who was a gastroenterologist who thought perhaps that there was an aneurysm in one of his major arteries that ran through his midsection. And so they did an MRI and found tumors in his pancreas, one of which was almost an inch big. The pancreas is not a very big little part of the body. Anyway, so they decided they would biopsy these, and that was going to be a few days later. So when they got to biopsy, they discovered that some of the tumors had shrunk. And in fact, they had shrunk to the point where it was not safe to try to do a needle biopsy. So they said, well, you know, on Monday we're going to open him up and see for ourselves what's going on, and we'll just biopsy them then. And Monday came, they opened him up, found nothing but healthy tissue. In the meantime, his uncle, who was a medical missionary, although he was a dentist, seemed to feel that he had some healing powers, and he went to work on this friend of ours. And who knows what really happened. But at any rate, he came free of what had been diagnosed as pancreatic cancer. And later when I spoke with him, he said, the only thing that mattered to me, knowing I was dying, didn't matter to me that I wasn't married, didn't matter to me that I hadn't gone and done a standard type job in the United States, didn't matter to me that I didn't have children. The only thing that mattered to me is that I had not come to awakening. And he went back to practice and has been practicing and going to Sesshin ever since. So at the moment of our death, what really mattered to us? How will we respond? Some people go remarkably easily. Other people fight it tooth and nail, filled with fear, struggling to avoid it. So the poem in one of the koans in the Mumonkan goes, how will it be for you when the light of your eyes is falling? Will you be like the crab with its 7 arms and 8 legs trying to get out of the boiling water? But let's continue on with this letter from Dawi. An ancient sage said, subtle arisings of deluded thought are the disease. Subtle arisings of deluded thought are the disease. They pull us far away from the truth. Not continuing them is the medicine. That's not that easy, at least not initially, but we can train ourselves to do it. Do not fear the arising of thoughts, fear the failure to become aware of them. Buddha means aware or awake. It is because Buddhas are continuously aware that they're known as great aware ones, or kings of awareness. Moreover, all Buddhas are awakened and came forth from among the ranks of ordinary people, like each one of us. They were worthy practicers. Why cannot I too be like that? Well, we can. It takes effort, it takes commitment, but we can. Depends on how much it does matter to us. Even if you were to live 100 years, how much time is that? Practice from moment to moment as though trying to extinguish flames on your head. Even when engaged in good works, we fear being unable to carry them through. How much more frightening, then, is it to be mired from one moment to the next in the dusts of delusion without ever attaining awakening? Recently, at the beginning of the fourth month, Lu Juren sent me a letter in which he informed me of the deaths of Zheng Shuxia and Liu Yanli. Juren commented, "Once more I've lost several of my friends. This transiency is truly what we must keep in mind." Juren has recently become quite serious with regard to resolving the great matter and regrets that he was rather late in this change to his thinking. In reply, I wrote to him the other day and said, "Just take as true that final thought where you realized your error. Do not be concerned with early or late. There's no point in judging where we are in our practice or where we think we are in our practice because we really don't know. One foot in front of the next. One extended out breath filled with yearning to be free, to return to our true home, to find that original face after the other. Onward, 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 resisting the temptations to look any direction other than that. The realization of your error forms the foundation of your becoming a Buddha and a master, comprises a sharp instrument for cutting through the nets of the demons, and provides the path for escaping samsara. I hope that you too will practice in this way. As your practice throughout the day gradually matures, you will notice a lessening in the effort it requires. With this realization, do not slacken off. Just follow all the way through with this lessening of effort, remaining in accord with it, whether coming or going. When you are no longer even aware of this lessened effort, then indeed you are close. Just examine that koan. Do not concern yourself with whether or not you will gain realization. With my best wishes." So it's natural to run into distractions, to run into what we call makyo, devilish phenomena. These are just boulders that come down in front of us as we try to practice. But like that water that isn't stopped by the bamboo, which if you've ever seen bamboo growing, it's quite thick. And the mountain peaks don't stop the clouds from moving onward. Don't be stopped, but don't fight with it. Allow yourself to experience the energy of this blocking. And then right in the midst of that, Extend that out breath deep within, reaching, reaching for that truth that lies there. Keep going like that and you will find it. And it will be a miraculous moment for you. And then, of course, you need to move towards putting it into action. That's the other part of practice. That's why we call it realization. Making it real in our life. I thank you for listening, and we'll stop now and recite the